Greetings. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Greg Laughlin, Chairman of the Astronomy and Astrophysics Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Greg is the author of the feature article, How Worlds Get Out of Whack, in the March 2013 issue of Sky and Telescope. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
What's the latest thinking on how planets actually form?
I think it's very clear that planets form through the accretion of smaller bodies, and I think it's clear that planets like Jupiter and Saturn form when the solid core at the center then accretes a lot of gas from the surrounding nebula. But beyond that, I think that there are some major unanswered questions about planet formation, and I'm hopeful that the trove of new data is going to help things get sorted out over the next few years.
And this is what's interesting, too, is, you know, going back to 1995, I remember being totally blown away by the discovery of the planet around 51 Pegasi, which you briefly mentioned in the article. Here was a Jupiter-mass planet in a ridiculously short 4.2-day orbit. Yet from your article, it was clear that astronomers already had a ready-made explanation for these so-called hot Jupiters, that is, planetary migration. When you first heard about the 51 Pegasi planet in 1995, did your thoughts immediately turn to the possibility of migration?
No. Unfortunately, they didn't. And, you know, they should have. I had read the Tremain and Goldreich papers from the 1970s in a class that I had on planetary rings, and I knew a little bit about the COSI mechanism. But I, like so many others, didn't make that connection either before the planets were discovered, which would have been really great, or even immediately afterward. Someone who did make the connection was my colleague Doug Lin here at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and he, as soon as he heard about the discovery of 51 Peg, he recruited Peter Bodenheimer and Derek Richardson, and they just worked around the clock for a couple of days to make a model, which is basically the Type 2 migration model that we still talk about today, for explaining how that bizarre world got to its bizarre location.
Remember the period before 51 Pegasi was discovered, when computer simulations of planetary formation were just spitting out these planetary systems that were almost carbon copies of our solar system. You know, small planets close to the star, big planets farther out. But in many of these systems in the real galaxy, we see that there's big planets close in. So do you think that migration was the missing ingredient in our expectations of what other planetary systems should look like?
That's a very interesting question. I think that what happens when you do these large-scale simulations is you have lots of knobs that you can turn on the dashboard, if you will. And if you know in advance what you're looking for, even if it's a kind of an unconscious bias, then the simulations, you'll fool around and you'll run different simulations and you'll eventually get ones that look like the way you want them to look. And those are the ones that tend to get published. So I think it's even more than missing the aspect of migration. I think that large-scale Monte Carlo simulations of planet formation back then, and even now, they're in some sense reflections of what you want to find, not reflections of what actually happens. And the planet formation process, I think that because the solar system now appears to be slightly unusual, and because the solar system doesn't look like the average solar system in the galaxy, I think that there's been sort of biases that have been baked in from the start that have kind of made it difficult to really sort out what's really going on.
You start off your article by talking about the rings of Saturn, and an article about the rings of Saturn is actually the cover story of the issue in which your article appears. So how has the study of Saturn's rings played a role in understanding migration and the evolution of these exoplanetary systems?
Saturn's rings are a great proxy for situations where you have planets embedded in a disk. In the case of Saturn's rings, the disk is, you know, sort of a cloud of icy particles that are orbiting in a very narrow plane, rather than gas and dust. But the physics, in many cases, are very similar. And what's really remarkable about Saturn's rings is that we've got Cassini. Originally, we had Voyager flyby, but now we've got Cassini out there making extraordinarily detailed observations. And so you can really, really close the loop between theory and observation with Saturn's rings, and you can really gain a strict and a rigorous and full appreciation of what's going on there. That's something that you really can't do with the planet formation process. In the case of planets, we have a whole interesting panel play of leftover clues in our own solar system, everything from the positions and the spacing and the composition of the planets to the composition of primitive meteorites. And we have observations of planet-forming disks around other stars, but we don't have that kind of ability to zero in and look at the disk-planet interactions that are occurring in the planet-forming context. And so Saturn's rings are a very important proxy for making sure that the theoretical ideas are on the right track.
And staying within our solar system, how much planet migration do you think has happened here? And in particular, do you think Earth moved inward or outward from the time it formed?
So there's one very clear signature of migration in our own solar system, and that is that Neptune certainly migrated outward by, you know, at least several AU. And the reason why we know that is because it swept the Plutinos and the Tutinos into mean motion resonance. You know, as Neptune moved out, it kind of captured all these errant bodies like Pluto and kept them in resonance along with it as it moved out. So there's a very clear dynamical signature that that occurred. So we know that Neptune moved out. And it's, I think, quite clear that all four of the giant planets did migrate to a certain degree. Jupiter probably moved inward a little bit. Saturn and Uranus probably moved outward. And it's possible that Saturn and Jupiter actually migrated quite a ways. There's an interesting theory called the Grand Tack Hypothesis. And the Grand Tack Hypothesis has Jupiter and Saturn basically coming all the way in to the, sort of the outer part of the inner solar system before going back out again. And this would occur because of interactions with the planetesimal disk that surrounded them. So I think that our own solar system did experience migration to a certain degree, but it's, I think, the jury is still out as to exactly what happened. And with respect to terrestrial planets like Earth and Venus, there's no explicit evidence that there was any migration. There's no evidence that Earth was moved any large distance from where it accreted from smaller bodies.
And then your article also mentions several migration scenarios. You talk about the type 1 and type 2 migration that's sort of driven by the disk. And then you talked about the Kozai mechanism.
Yeah.
And in that little sidebar, you talked about the planetesimal driven migration. Which of these mechanisms do you think occurs most frequently in planetary systems?
Well, I think that in planetary systems that we can readily observe, and especially planetary systems that we can readily observe in transit, there, I think there's increasing evidence that the Kozai migration process I talk about in the article is the major player. What's nice about Kozai is that it's a three-body effect, and so it's really tied explicitly to Newton's laws of gravitation, which we completely understand, and there's really no unknown physics in that process. It's, I think, very well characterized, and it's something that's guaranteed to happen if the conditions are right. And it's not that hard to create the conditions for Kozai migration to occur. What you need is a planet on an orbit that's tilted with respect to a binary plane. And that's something that doesn't seem to be hard to achieve at all, and in fact should be achieved on a regular basis. So Kozai migration, I think, is on a very stable footing. Planetesimal migration is also on stable footing in the sense that it was clearly planetesimal migration that generated Neptune's outward movement. And planetesimal migration is physically very similar to migration driven by a gas disk. In both cases, you're running a gravitational wake through the disk, and the back reaction of that wake, the gravitational pull from the wake itself, is what is causing the migration to occur. So that also is on, I think, pretty good footing, but in that case, the initial conditions are a little less clear. While it's certainly guaranteed that it will occur if you can set things upright, it's not as clear that you can set things upright as is the case with Kozai.
And then there's the fact that planets can move substantial distances from their formation orbits and can interact gravitationally with one another and their disk. That would seem to indicate that a lot of systems are unstable. Do you think there might be a lot of planets that have been ejected from their host stars and are just right now roaming the Milky Way galaxy unattached to a star? If this is happening, like how many such rogue planets might be out there?
Well, certainly planetary systems do go unstable, and with not clear that the number is as high as that observation indicates. But clearly, we do see planetary systems that have undergone some serious instabilities in the past.
There are a lot of these free-floating planets out there. I mean, is there ever a danger that one of them could wander into the solar system and maybe start to disrupt the orbits in our solar system?
Well, that's a legitimate question. I think that right now, the estimates for the number of free-floating planets are ranging up to one or two free-floating planets per star. And so what that means is that the chances that a rogue planet will wander through the solar system, pass through the solar system, is probably a better way to put it, about the same that a field star will pass through the solar system. Turns out that there's about a 1 in 100,000 chance that the planets in our solar system will get disrupted by a passing star before the sun turns into a red giant. Those are pretty low odds, and interestingly, the odds are much higher that the planets will undergo a gravitational instability of their own accord before the sun turns into a red giant. Recent calculations by Jacques Lascar have shown that there's about 1% chance that the inner solar system will destabilize itself within the next 5 billion years, which is, luckily, it's low from an overall standpoint. Certainly nothing's going to happen for the next 150 million years in any case. But the fact that it's as high as 1% is slightly shocking. On the flip side, there's a 1 in 3 million chance that a red dwarf passing through the solar system will capture Earth into orbit and basically steal the Earth. If that happens, life on Earth lasts for much longer because the red dwarf will last in the main sequence for trillions of years. So all of these things are kind of in the realm almost of science fiction, very low probability events. And in all likelihood, our solar system will not be impacted by a rogue planet and will not be impacted by a rogue star and will be finished off in kind of an ordinary, mundane way by the sun turning into a red giant.
That answers the questions that I had. Was there anything else that you wanted to add that I did not ask you about?
Not at the moment. I think that it's exciting that Kepler is out there and is returning data. And I think that the Sky Telescope is a great venue for reporting the finding in a way that's scientifically accurate, doesn't dumb it down, doesn't sensationalize it, but at the same time is accessible and understandable. So I think that it's got to be an exciting time to be working at the magazine now when there's all this exciting stuff coming out and you get to parse through it and kind of make the interpretations that can make a difference.
Yeah, I should point out that I've known you for many years and have been reporting on exoplanets since the 51 Pegasi discovery, and just the progress in this field over the last 20 years has just been unbelievable, and it's also been incredible, and I know you've had a big role in this, that amateur astronomers have actually played a really significant and increasing role in this. I think that's really cool, too.
Yeah, they really have, and not just in, you know, one or two sort of specific corners, but in a lot of different areas. Amateurs were key players in the discovery of some of the most interesting long-period transiting planets. Amateurs have played a huge role in the microlensing detections. And now, interestingly, with the Kepler data, something that's wonderful about Kepler, and indeed about all of NASA's missions, is the data is released to the public pretty quickly. You know, it's sort of cleaned up, vetted, make sure that there's no errors of analysis. And then the data is given out. And amateurs are really starting to make good progress with the Kepler data. There's projects like Planet Hunters, but then there are also individuals, for instance, Howard Rells in Florida, who are really digging in and going after the characterization of some of these planetary systems. And at first, they need to be sort of brought up to speed, but they get up to speed quite rapidly. In general, they often have extremely good technical skills, and they're really making contributions. And so I think that the Kepler data is going to occupy astronomers for literally decades in much the same way that the Voyager data did. And I think because of the internet, because everybody's got a supercomputer on their desks,